This show proudly sponsored by Real American Freestyle Wrestling. Hi, everyone. It's Brian Kilmeade here. Are you tired of those uncomfortable dress shirts, especially when they bunch up under a sweater? If so, then you must check out Collars & Co., makers of the Dress Collar Polo. Listen up. These shirts are four-way stretch, buttery soft polos with firm dress collars on them, so they give you the dress shirt look, but extremely comfortable polo feel. You can wear them with anything, under a sweater, with a blazer, or by themselves as an elevated polo. They work for any occasion. These polos are perfect, whether it's in the office, on a golf course or a night out. Collars & Co. is exploding and have gone viral on social media thanks to the $1 million investment they received on Shark Tank from Mark Cuban and Peter Jones. You don't have to worry about collars that flop down and spread out. They stay firm and sharp all day. It's an amazing array of sweaters, quarter zips, pants, and outerwear. If you're looking for the performance dress shirt or polo that looks great all day, check out collarsandco.com. Use promo code Brian for 15% off of any purchase of $100 or more. That's promo code Brian.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show, Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're there. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show, going at 100 miles an hour here on right at 1211 6th Avenue in Midtown Manhattan, where there's going to be a big debate tonight for the mayor's race. This hour, got three great guests. Congressman Buddy Carter of Georgia, Dennis Ross. He is an extremely well-respected Middle East scholar, as well as Senator Joni Ernst, Armed Services, Homeland Security, and Chairman of the Rural Development and Energy Committees. She's going to be with us in a matter of moments. And I just got to tell you also, the President of the United States, we don't know details, but he's going to have a press conference at 3 o'clock. He's got an announcement. What else is new? He gets his intelligence briefings at 11. So let's get to the big three.
Number three.
They are refusing to do their job. They're grasping for straws. They're trying to make this about political tabloids and political intrigue and horse races, exactly the kinds of things that people are sick of in this country.
Day 16 of the shutdown. Tempers flare and Dems' socialistic side takes the lead. No doubt about it. Showing how split the standoff and this country is, I'll explain.
Number two.
The biggest challenge is getting Hamas out of control of Gaza, and that's looking actually as elusive as ever. And a big question is, how much capital is Trump going to spend? If Hamas continues to take power, it's going to take buy-in from the Arab allies to really push them out.
Gaza peace deal making some in-game adjustments as Hamas refuses to put down their weapons and return 19 bodies of Israelis they murdered. We'll have the latest.
Number one.
Would you give President Trump credit or not? To any extent, credit or not?
I think it's too early to do so.
Too early to say.
But if it proves to be something that is lasting, something that is durable, then I think that's where you give credit.
Really? The 20 hostages out, you get no credit? That is Zohran Mamdani. The debate day for the New York City's mayor's race. And the world is watching as the front runner, Zohran, sits down with Fox to smile his way through his wacky policies. Senator Joni Ernst joins us now. Senator, when you look at the Democratic Party, do you think of Joe Manchin or do you think of AOC and Bernie Sanders and Zohran Mamdani? Like, how do you view the opposite party?
Well, right now, it certainly isn't that party of Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, you know, people that would come together and work with us on issues. We see it now as the party of Bernie Sanders and AOC, and that can be very dangerous, I think, for those that truly do love our country and the way we've developed over the last 2.5 centuries. So it's very scary, and we are seeing the results of that here on Capitol Hill during this government shutdown, where we see Democrats now pushing further and further to the left. They want to eventually get to a one-payer system when it comes to health care. And it's really frustrating right now for so many people in middle America, like Iowa, where I come from. They just don't understand the mindset of these New York elites that are, you know, striving for socialism.
Because Hakeem Jeffries and Senator Schumer live within a mile of each other in Brooklyn. So that's what you're talking about. That's leadership on the left, both of which have not endorsed the one who won the Democratic primary in Manhattan, the biggest city and the financial center of the country, arguably the world. So they're having trouble figuring out what direction their party wants to go in. AOC came out last night and said, well, you know, it's a bad precedent because if a moderate wins the nomination, I'm supposed to go support that moderate. So they have some problems.
They do have problems, and I don't feel one iota bit sorry for AOC. I do think we need more people that are willing to work together. We've got some serious issues in the federal government right now. We are trying to right-size our federal government when our taxpayers are forking more and more money out to support a bloated bureaucracy. There are issues. So we are desperately trying to get to where we need to be in order to support our constituencies and also do the right thing by our taxpayers.
You also said you're doing a study to find out how much we're actually losing during this shutdown. And you said the price tag has blown past $4.4 billion.
Oh, yes, Brian. We have the Schumer shutdown shenanigans have already wasted $4.8 billion. We are spending $400 million per workday by paying 750,000 federal employees not to work. And we're losing that money because they will get paid, these federal employees. They're at home or, you know, hanging out, doing whatever while they're not working. But it means we don't have that work being done in the offices. So it means they'll have to come back. We'll have to maybe pay overtime, whatever it happens to be. But they're still getting paid that $400 million every single day. And we have no productivity to show for it. So this is what Leader Schumer is doing with the Schumer shutdown. It's costing our taxpayers that much money. So I do have a non-essential workers transparency act, and it will expose the lost productivity and the exact cost of this Democratic party's national political stunt. So it requires these federal agencies to detail the number of furloughed employees during a shutdown and the cost of paying them not to work. So again, it's a lot of money wasted during this shutdown, and we can pin that blame directly on Leader Schumer. Chuck Schumer is the one that has shut down this government because of his far-left base's
right.
demands.
I understand that. Here's what Bernie Sanders said last night as he and AOC, who are the pulse of the party right now, sadly, two socialists. Cut 21.
We're going to do everything that we can to bring an end to this terrible shutdown, which is hurting you and which is hurting a million federal employees and millions of people who use federal services. But also, we have got to be cognizant that if Trump wins this fight, our healthcare system could well collapse and tens of thousands of people could die every single year.
Do you think Trump could win this fight?
No, we're going to win it. But it's not, I don't want to look at it like a political fight. We're going to win it because the American people are on our side.
The stats say, I think 67% blame Republicans, 63% blame Democrats. I saw a poll that was just the opposite. So it's roughly people are upset at both parties. But what he wants to do is restructure health care, which is not on the table.
Right, exactly. And that's what they are fighting over, Brian, is what they are trying to do is extend these COVID era expanded subsidies for Obamacare. So what happened during COVID? The Democrats expanded, you know, the subsidies, which tells me, one, that Obamacare, if we have to fork out these giant subsidies, Obamacare is not affordable, bottom line. And here they are trying to extend them even longer. This is not part of the debate. This is not part of the we need to open federal government up. What President Trump has said is open up the government, and then we'll talk about this separate issue of the expanded subsidies. But what we have to remember is we have to return to fiscal sanity and pre-pandemic levels. I want to make sure that we are taking care of people that need to be taken care of, but we also need reforms in place.
Because Obamacare is a disaster. We're trying to bail out a program that's not working.
Yes. Yes, it is not working, which is why we have to throw so much money at this program to make it work for Joe on the street. And when do you say when? How much more money and time are we going to throw at a system that is broken? Are we going to have to expand it even more? $40 billion? How much more are we going to throw at this? It is broken. It is not affordable. It is not working for the American people.
And we know that illegal immigrants are getting these social services. And we know that in Oregon, for example, more money is spent on health care for illegals than cops. So you have a bigger budget for illegal immigrants than you do for your law enforcement. That's how upside down that state is, that city is. I want to bring you to something else. You're from an ag state, obviously the quintessential ag state in Iowa. And people are upset that the Chinese have decided not to buy our soybeans or our agricultural products. And now as we go to bail out Argentina, it has dropped the price of their soybeans, and China is buying their soybeans at a discount rate while we bail out the country. Are you okay with that?
I am not. So I've actually raised this issue with Secretary Rollins over at USDA. We were visiting about this just yesterday morning, and then I spoke directly to our U.S. trade rep, Jameson Greer, yesterday as well. And if this is the way it's going to be, and Argentina is selling their soybeans to China instead of China buying from the U.S., then Argentina needs to buy product from Middle America, from Iowa.
Yeah.
They can be backfilling their soybeans with our soybeans or our soybean crush. So we need to make sure that any deals that we're engaging in can also benefit our American farmers. They are really getting the short end of the stick. We need more trade, not more aid.
I hear you. Senator Joni Ernst, thanks so much. When we come back, Congressman Buddy Carter is going to be with us in Georgia. Then Dennis Ross on the latest from Gaza. And there is a lot of moving parts there and an interesting proposal about providing some security in Gaza. Don't move.
It's Brian Kilmeade.
Every day, America's first responders stand ready. Firefighters, law enforcement, paramedics, doctors, dispatchers, and people who put themselves on the line for public safety. But keeping them connected in moments of crisis has not been easy. That's why Congress authorized a nationwide network for public safety. Today, that promise is fulfilled through FirstNet. It's the only nationwide network built with and for first responders. So whether it's a big city, rural town, or remote tribal community, FirstNet helps ensure no call for help goes unanswered. It gives first responders priority access, never throttles their communications in the U.S., helping them to connect across agencies when it matters most. This isn't just a network. It's a lifeline, a bipartisan commitment to America's public safety, built to serve those who serve us all. FirstNet is the backbone of our nation's emergency response and will continue to be in the future. FirstNet, built with AT&T. Learn more on firstnet.com/public safety first.
From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
We are back, and let's bring in Congressman Buddy Carter of Georgia, the Budget and Energy Committee right now. The House is out. The Republican side of the House is now out until they can get the government back because they already did their vote and handed it to the Senate. That's where it all fell apart. Without 60 votes, we're in a shutdown. And Congressman Buddy Carter is going to be running for the Senate against John Ossoff. But, of course, he's got to get through the primary first. Congressman, how frustrating has this been for the Republicans?
Well, it's very frustrating for us as House members because we've done our job. We passed a continuing resolution, a clean continuing resolution, and we passed it through November 21st for 7 weeks so that we could continue to work on the budget. And the Democrats in the Senate, they're holding it up, and they're voting against it. In fact, they voted against it. Our Senator John Ossoff has voted against it 10 times. And you know, this is something that's really disturbing because John Ossoff is choosing to side with the Democratic party and their values more so than the values of the state of Georgia. Georgians want this to end, and they understand that we need to negotiate on the health care subsidies, but we need to open up the government. We should not be holding our troops and our federal employees hostage like the Democrats are in order to achieve something that the Democrats want to achieve, and that is getting health care for illegal immigrants.
The way you do it is they would give the money to the hospitals, not directly to them. But in cities like Oregon, I understand there's money given directly to illegal immigrants, which is a sanctuary city, and it's more than they give to the cops. But what do you say to people who say, well, it's not direct payments to illegal immigrants?
No, but it's still payments. Look, I've heard that argument. I chaired the Health Subcommittee of Energy and Commerce the first 6 months of this year before I was a candidate for the Senate. And during that time, we are the ones who came up with the changes that were part of the Medicaid changes that saved and stabilized Medicaid and were part of the Working Families Tax Cut Act. And what we said is that those states that are covering illegal immigrants on Medicaid, that they are going to be penalized for that. And, you know, the states were arguing, these Democratic states tried to argue the point. They would say, oh, well, we're using state dollars and not federal dollars. Well, come on, guys. You're using federal dollars to replace the state dollars that you're using there. You know, I was born at night, but it wasn't last night. Don't try to fool me on this.
So that's the shutdown continues. There's not going to be any movement, it doesn't seem, by Thune on this. Do you think it has a lot to do with the No Kings rally on Saturday?
I do think it has a lot to do with that. I think it's and perhaps that'll be the impetus, if you will, to end all this, and that they'll come to their senses, and that they will they'll vote, and we'll get the government back open next week. That's my hope, anyway.
You're losing $4.4 billion already. But the big question is, the Speaker of the House says this is all about AOC primarying Chuck Schumer, and he has to look tough. Here's what they said last night in their town hall that nobody watched. Cut 23.
But are you saying that Senator Schumer should not be worried about a primary challenge from you?
I mean, no.
Let me jump in on this one. Nobody cares. So one more time.
Nobody cares. It's the House Speaker and President Trump and the Vice President saying it.
Right.
Pardon?
Well, of course, they're saying it to deflect attention away from the real issues.
Exactly.
And here, let me tell you what the real issue is. Let's see if CNN talks about it. We're living in the richest country in the history of the world, right? All right. You tell me why we're the only nation not to guarantee health care to all people.
That's not true. But plus, we have the quality health care, and it's such a complicated question. We know one thing, Congressman. Obamacare is almost impossible to finance.
It is impossible to finance, and it's going to crush us as a country if we don't do something to get it under control. And that's what we're trying to do. Look, at the end of the day, we all want the same thing. We want accessible, affordable, quality health care. Whether you're a Democrat, an independent, or a Republican, you want that for our citizens. And we want to work toward that in the Republican Party. But the way that the Democrats are going about it, particularly with this shutdown, to try to achieve something that they want to achieve, and that is health care for illegal immigrants, that's not going to achieve our goal here.
I guess not. I also want to talk about what's happening over with Venezuela. Yesterday, the CIA came out, the New York Times had a story about the CIA basically covert action to dislodge Maduro. We know we're blowing up his boats. We know he sent his gangs over here to create havoc in our country, and they've been successful in doing that until recently. And we know we've now shut down the border, which is shutting down a lot of their revenue. What do you think should happen with Venezuela? And are you comfortable with the CIA moving in?
Well, and, you know, they're not moving in without President Trump's approval. And look, President Trump, I have so much confidence in him. He is trying to achieve peace here. And I know it looks like, well, that's not peace, but he's trying to achieve peace through strength. And by doing this and by attacking them where it hurts them the most, and you just pointed it out, he secured that border. They are losing revenue, and that is getting their attention. By doing that, he's going to achieve that and stabilize Venezuela. And that's something I think, again, another example of where this president, the president of peace, will be able to bring about stability in the world.
He wants Central and South America free of China influence, and that's why he's looking to sustain this Argentinian government. Could you talk about the big picture there?
The big picture there, the Argentinian government, look, what a great case study and the way that the things should be done and can be done. This is something that we ought to hold up and put in the textbooks and say, hey, look here, this is a good thing here. So that's an example, I think, of where President Trump, again, is using strength, peace through strength, and again, this is an example of where he is the president of peace.
Yeah, Argentina, he's going to be bailing out with giving $20 billion, but he's doing it by buying their currency. So we'll see if that's going to pan out, because a lot of people say, we can't bail them out. But if the big picture is keeping China out, and Argentina would agree to that, while buying our soybeans, that might be things that it's a win-win for our countries. Congressman, good luck with your Senate run. Thanks so much. Ambassador Dennis Ross is next. He's one of the premier experts on the Middle East. I cannot wait for him to weigh in on this historic peace plan the president put together and used Arab Gulf states as well as the support of the people of Israel. Hi, everyone. It's Brian Kilmeade here. Are you tired of those uncomfortable dress shirts, especially when they bunch up under a sweater? If so, then you must check out Collars & Co., makers of the Dress Collar Polo. Listen up. These shirts are four-way stretch, buttery soft polos with firm dress collars on them, so they give you the dress shirt look, but extremely comfortable polo feel. You can wear them with anything, under a sweater, with a blazer, or by themselves as an elevated polo. They work for any occasion. These polos are perfect, whether it's in the office, on a golf course, or a night out. Collars & Co. is exploding and have gone viral on social media thanks to the $1 million investment they received on Shark Tank from Mark Cuban and Peter Jones. You don't have to worry about collars that flop down and spread out. They stay firm and sharp all day. It's an amazing array of sweaters, quarter zips, pants, and outerwear. If you're looking for the performance dress shirt or polo that looks great all day, check out collarsandco.com. Use promo code Brian for 15% off of any purchase of $100 or more. That's promo code Brian.
A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
One thing to understand is some of these countries need an international mandate, like through the UN, to contribute the troops. They need and want it according to their local laws, right, or their constitution.
And
that's where we come in. We're working through all of those pieces right now as we speak. So,
Ambassador Michael Waltz of the UN, talking about getting the rest of the bodies back and also stopping the execution of Hamas, just killing people that they thought were against them. And they say our collaborators, we know that's folly. Dennis Ross joins us now, one of the most respected Middle East minds out there today, worked for Republicans as well as Democratic leaders, author of Statecraft 2.0, What America Needs to Lead a Multipolar World, and they're trying to lead again. Ambassador, your thoughts of phase one of this deal so far, with 20 hostages out and thousands of prisoners exchanged?
Well, look, I think the most important thing is that those 20 hostages are out.
Yep.
That should have been the main preoccupation, and it's been delivered. And that's, one should not underestimate the significance of that. And it is, I think, an extraordinary achievement, especially after 2 years, especially when so many people thought that Hamas would never give up the live hostages. Now, we may see them, what Hamas is doing now, by saying they don't know where their rests are, or that there's some are really hard to recover, meaning the live hostages return, but they seem to be playing games with the bodies.
Is that what you believe? Because here's what they said. For the remaining bodies, they require great efforts and special equipment to search for and extract them, and we are making a great effort to close that file. Do you not believe them?
I take everything they say with a huge grain of salt. They were clearly conveying in the past that they knew the whereabouts of hostages. To be fair, I'm sure there are some that it will take. It'll take machinery to recover them. But if that was the case, that should have been clear, and they should have made it clear much earlier. One thing we know, the Egyptians have very good intelligence in Gaza, and they're working. The Turks are now working as well. No one wants this to break down. So I do think this is an issue. Even if I think they've been playing games, I do think this is an issue that will get resolved.
So a couple of things. The U.S. sees the execution of 33 so-called collaborators by Hamas. There's about 7,000 left. They reestablished security positions. I've also seen online some video of other clans, many, I think a few of which have been supplied by the IDF and deemed as people that we can, that the IDF and Israel can work with. Now the U.S. is working with Israel to create safe zones to shelter Gazans who are scared that Hamas is going to exert some type of influence or try to kill them with their brutal crackdown. What should be the next step in this winner-take-all craziness of Gaza?
Look, I wrote last week after President Trump announced that there was a deal, but before it was finalized, I said one of the first things we're going to see is that Hamas will try to reassert its control by going after some of these clans. It's exactly what they did. So one of the things that has to happen again is we need to reestablish on the part of those who are the mediators and who have influence on Hamas, meaning Turkey and Qatar and Egypt, just because they're next door, they need to establish very quickly with Hamas what are the ground rules. And the ground rules are this kind of execution, this kind of action stops.
And you want to hear that, right? Do you have to, Ambassador, how would they do that? Would they say that publicly, or we get, according to reports, Egyptian officials have communicated to Hamas that these executions will stop? Like, we're waiting for the, we always know where the U.S. stands, where Israel stands, and the Palestinian Authority perhaps got it. But the difference now, I hope, ideally, is these Arab nations, these Muslim nations, these Gulf states have to start asserting themselves. This is their moment.
You know, Brian, I could not agree with you more. I've been saying what makes this certain moment different than anything we've seen in the past when it comes to peacemaking. I see an increasing readiness on the part of key Arab states to assume responsibility on the Palestinian issue that they have never assumed before. I can tell you in the year 2000, when we were trying to get Arafat to agree to, by the way, what most of his own negotiating delegation wanted to accept, we wanted the Arab states to go and lean on him to get him to say yes. And they didn't do it. And why didn't they do it? Because at that time they feared Arafat would stand up and say, you know, the king of Saudi Arabia is pressing me to betray the Palestinian national cause and I won't do it. And no one at that time on the Arab side wanted to be in a position where he could accuse them of that. Now, there's two differences today, maybe three. The first, there is no Palestinian leader with the stature of Arafat. He was iconic. Second, the Arabs at that time never felt the responsibility to settle the conflict. Yeah, they wanted it done, but it was up to us to settle it, not up to them. And the third thing is that there is now among Arab states, increasingly, especially the Gulf states, the Saudis and the Emiratis, a recognition that this war, not just today, but the conflict itself has to end because it is a distortion. It is causing them not to be able to pursue what are their real priorities. Yep. It means we're going to, we have the chance. It's not a given, and we shouldn't take it as a given, and nothing is self-executing. But we now have a chance to get the Arabs to assume a role that they've never been prepared to assume before. That's what's new in this situation.
And this is, to me, much more promising than when you were dealing with this every single day. I mean,
absolutely.
And you, by the way, you had this two-state solution proposal. Clinton had the two-state solution. And this is why Hillary Clinton sounds like Trump. And, you know, was not jumping on every Democratic saying the Palestinians are the problem. Excuse me. Every Democrat was saying Palestinians are the problem. Hamas has got a point. But Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton would never say that because you guys were so close to providing the West Bank and Gaza and a bridge or a tunnel connecting both places with a portion of Jerusalem and Ehud Barak. Was willing to do what almost no other Israeli leader was going to do and do that. And Yasser Arafat goes, no, I'll be killed the next day. I'm walking away from it. That's where the anger comes from your side in the 90s, right?
Absolutely. Look, I'll tell you, I had a dinner in Rawabi, which is a town in the West Bank, actually quite a remarkable one in the West Bank. And it was with one of the former Palestinian negotiators. It was about 18 months ago, and he says to me, can you imagine where we would be today if we had said yes?
Unbelievable. Yeah.
Now, they wanted this. The point is, the whole Palestinian delegation wanted to say yes, and Arafat said no.
But this is what's different, Dennis. And you know, obviously you're the superstar in this area. But here's what's different. I think these Gulf states and these Arab states, they're thinking about their economy. They're thinking about getting their people going. What I'm seeing in Saudi Arabia, with all their faults and all their past, and I get Khashoggi and everything like that. They changed the curriculum in Saudi Arabia. You have people growing up now wanting to be business people. Yeah, they're trying to get entertainment. You have American comedians going over there. They're trying to be part of the golf world. They want to host a World Cup. That's not an insular society who want to one day turn over every government and march to Mecca. Like, there's a different goal for some of these Gulf states now. And I think they see that Israel's not going anywhere. They have never been more powerful. They just put on an awesome military display, something I would write back in a novel, and I'd say, well, this is great novel, but they'll never happen. But they did. So these Arab states go, I don't want any part of that. I have a bigger problem with Iran than I have with Israel. And let's just get our economies intermingled and let's start moving forward. This is a much different potential. This is much more hopeful.
It is a different world. Brian, you put your finger on it. People don't say this, but we have seen a social revolution in Saudi Arabia. Whatever, you know, yes, should Khashoggi have ever happened? Absolutely not. Reprehensible. But at the same time, what's happened in Saudi Arabia has literally been a revolution. I want to tell you a story. When I was there, and I go to Saudi Arabia probably every 6 months, and I had someone from the royal court, a young woman who was maybe 31, who was making the arrangements for me to go to my various meetings. And I asked her, you know, what her ambitions were. And she said, oh, I want to go into I'm a pharmacist by training, but I want to get into biomeds. And I said, is that something you would have been able to imagine before? And she laughed. She said, no, before I might have had dreams, but I would have known I couldn't act on them. Now I know I can act on them. This is a woman, a 31-year-old woman. This would have been unthinkable in the Saudi Arabia of the past. So we're dealing with a very different Saudi Arabia, a very different Emirates. And there's one other point I want to make. If you go back to what was the so-called Arab Spring in 2011, the effect that had on a number of states, including the Gulf states, was, you know what, that could happen to us, meaning the upheavals that you saw in Tunisia, Egypt, Syria, Libya, that could happen to us unless we deliver decent governance, unless we deliver economies that meet the needs of people. That's when the change took place, because there was a recognition we have to change or that could happen to us.
That's so interesting. So the Arab Spring was a learning moment for governments that stayed in power, that we could either really repress and double and triple down, right, and make people's life miserable and tell them that's the way it is and live for Allah. Or we could say, let's give these people some hope. And the war on terror, America's going to win that. They're going to drone you. They're going to find you wherever you are. And that's going to be it. So let's change. And the one that didn't want to change is Iran. And that's why,
right,
I believe in, you tell me, when you go over there, how many people are high-fiving that nuclear program is destroyed or set back seriously? And how many people understand that and that Iran was exposed? That, they could throw out some rockets, but they can't stop Israel.
You see, that's one of the points I've been making. A number of presidents, Republican, Democratic alike, including President Trump in his first term, even though he did act against Soleimani, there was this sense somehow of believing the Iranians when they would say, if you attack us directly, we'll set the region on fire. And it created for them a sense of impunity. And the rest of the region saw that. And they saw the use of proxies as a result.
Hezbollah, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, all of them.
So what Israel did is, not only did they dramatically weaken the proxy network, but then they exposed the fact that there is no impunity, and then the strikes that President Trump did on the three important nuclear infrastructure sites, not the only ones, but the three ones that we struck, Fordo, Isfahan, and Natanz, that made it clear Iran no longer has impunity. That's huge.
And I'm going to add another thing. The overthrow of Assad in Syria lost the Iran loses this huge ally, and Russia in Ukraine gets their eye off the ball. It never would have happened. If they didn't invade Ukraine and have all their assets elsewhere, Assad would still be in power. Iran and Russia would still have an ally. But now they find themselves isolated in that area. You have an Al-Qaeda guy, which worries me, who's in charge, but now says, I'm open to the, you know, being part of the Abraham Accords. And I'm not sure what's going to happen there. But I'll take that over Assad and another Russian ally in the region. So
well,
Iran is...
You know, you're right. Because what he did is there's no way Iran has a position any longer in Syria. Russia, Shara was just in Moscow yesterday saying we're going to live up to all the commitments we
had with
the Russians.
So the new leader of Syria was in Moscow yesterday?
Yeah.
Oh, that's not good.
So, but I'll tell you, you're right. This needs to be viewed with some caution. But the bigger issue for me is that Iran is out and can't get back in. The Hezbollah was the crown jewel for the Iranians and their proxy network, but Syria was the key to the proxy network, and that's gone. So that's huge. Look, the Russian connection is tied up with Turkey. It's not clear to me, by the way, that the Trump administration is necessarily opposed to this. To the Russian-Turkish-Syria connection. I would personally like to see us doing more to see if we can test if Shara is prepared to be as pragmatic as he says. I am a little weary of seeing the Russians in there because the agreement means they get to maintain the facilities they have, the naval and air facilities they have there.
That would be a disaster. Why wouldn't we use it as leverage for recognition? We recognized and we said we're going to lift the sanctions, and we didn't go ahead and say, by the way, cut your Russian connection off.
I wish we had done that.
Yeah, that's a big error. That's a huge error. And also, it's interesting because the president set up those relationships with the Gulf states and the region in order to combine with Israel to do the deal with the Palestinian situation. And finally, Palestinian technocrats who are supposed to take over, do they exist?
They do exist. They do exist, especially if they're drawn from the Palestinian diaspora outside of the area. Look, there can be some from the West Bank. There are some. I've known them in the past in Gaza. But there are also those internationally they can be drawn on. They do exist, but the question is going to be the issue of Hamas disarmament. If there isn't a credible approach to that, and it has to be mechanical, it has to have clear measures, what do we define as the endpoint of that? You're not going to disarm every single Hamas guy of his weapon. What's the measure of real disarmament? And how do we create the right linkage between disarmament and the process of Israeli withdrawal? That's really the crux of the matter. Because if you want independence in Gaza, the only way you get it is if Hamas is not in a position to coerce anybody there.
Exactly. And if it's only going to take Arab help, the IDF can go in there and try to wipe out the 7,000, but it'll create a little more. You know, there's got it there. I'm hopefully the Arab world can understand that there'll be, you know, they could be the alternative. Ambassador Dennis Ross, always great to talk to you. Thank you.
All right. Take care, Brian.
Back in a moment.
Don't go anywhere. Brian Kilmeade will be right back.
Hi, everyone. I'm Brian Kilmeade. It gives me great pleasure to tell you that Simply Safe is now available at 50% off because you're listening to this podcast. So go to simplysafe.com/Brian. Now, why is Simply Safe so perfect? Number one, it's easily put in. Number two, it's unbelievably effective. Number three, they're using AI now to stop the break-in, not just catch the people that are doing it, but to stop them before they infiltrate your life and destroy your personal property. I personally trust these people. This is a game changer. The agents take action while the intruder is still on the outside. They confront the intruder, letting them know they're being watched on camera, and you know they're going to head for the hills because they're going to head right to prison if they don't, and hopefully they still will. There are no long-term contracts. There are no hidden fees. Get this, the U.S. News and World Report, they named them, Simply Safe, the best home security system. There's a 60-day money-back guarantee. So what price can you put on safety? Well, Simply Safe is easy to install. They're always improving the product, and it's affordable. Why can't you be safe? The answer is, of course you can. Go get Simply Safe. Save your 50% by going to simplysafe.com/Brian. Get it.
A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
I think that we should have more Republicans on the show, but they don't want to come on. They're scared of us. It's like Marjorie Taylor Greene says that she finds the Republican men afraid of powerful women. Well, that may be true of all the political persuasions. But if they would come on this show, they can explain to us what they're trying to do to this country.
What they're trying to do to the country. Just watch our channel. You'll know exactly what we're trying to do to the country. Straighten it out. Get race out of everything. Stop with the woke policies. Begin to grow the economy by making it a true free market. Stop taking taxpayer dollars and pumping it into social programs that aren't effective. No one's afraid to go on, but they just don't see the plus side of going on. If you want to invite somebody on, you put on Tom Cotton, go ahead. Remember Bill O'Reilly went on there. They left. I think they left a couple of times. And not just with Bill, I think they've stormed out with somebody else too, right? Do you remember, Pete? But I think a couple of times they just stormed out because they don't like what they said. But they're not open, and that's fine. It's 4-on-1, 5-on-1. I know Clay Travis came out last night with Sean Hannity on his TV show, and he said, I would do it. You know, I don't see any benefit to going on there. Plus, I'm on the air right now. I don't think I'm ever going to take a day off to go on The View, nor do I know if I would be invited. But I don't think they're serious. I don't think they like contradictory opinions. Did you see the way they jumped all over RFK Jr.'s wife? Now, you think they like that? They used to be more balanced when Barbara Walters was there, when Elizabeth Hasselbeck was there, when Meghan McCain was there. But now they have a Republican that acts like a Democrat. So you go on there, it's like, okay, you go and all yell at me at the same time? I'm not going to help your ratings. Brian Kilmeade Show. Make sure November 1st, I want to see you in Pottstown, Pennsylvania. History, liberty, and laughs. I get to meet you in person. BrianKilmeade.com.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
It's Brian Kilmeade coming to you from Midtown Manhattan, heard around the country, around the world. Tonight is debate night in the big mayor's race that the whole country's watching. Between a socialist, a defamed governor, disgraced governor who wants to be Mayor Cuomo and thought he'd have a layup to do it, and to Curtis Sliwa, third place, but hanging tough. Yossi Cohen will be with us, former director of Mossad. It's going to be a thrill to talk to him. And Mark Thiessen is standing by, also a thrill. He's got a great column, and he equates the agreement that we reach with Hamas and how it can work for Putin. But first, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
They are refusing to do their job. They're grasping for straws. They're trying to make this about political tabloids and political intrigue and horse races, exactly the kinds of things that people are sick of in this country.
Department is day 16 of the shutdown. Tempers flare and Democratic Socialists side seem to take command of the Democratic Party. What's this going to do for the standoff and as the country loses billions of dollars while they don't work?
Number two.
The biggest challenge is getting Hamas out of control of Gaza, and that's looking actually as elusive as ever. And a big question is, how much capital is Trump going to spend? If Hamas continues to take power, it's going to take buy-in from the Arab allies to really push them out.
That is true, Josh Krashauer. Gaza peace deal making some gains and some in-game adjustments as Hamas refuses to put down their weapons and return 19 bodies of the Israelis they murdered. We have the latest.
Number one.
Would you give President Trump credit or not? To any extent, credit or not?
I think it's too early to do so.
Too early to say.
But if it proves to be something that is lasting, something that is durable, then I think that that's where you give credit.
Zoran Mamdani weighs in. Doesn't give the president credit for 20 returned live hostages. Debate day for the New York City mayor's race. And the world is watching. Frontrunner Zoran Mamdani sits down with Fox to smile his way through his wacky policies, which make no sense. Mark, do you see that free buses get you crime and a huge deficit? Do you know that getting rid of charter schools just hurts minorities? I assure you the gifted program in New York City is one of the big drawing, the drawing cards that he's going to get rid of. Let alone raising corporate taxes to get this. Be more like New Jersey, Mark Thiessen. Doesn't everybody want to have a tax structure like New Jersey?
Yes, exactly. I mean, look, if the people of New York elect this guy, they deserve what they get. It reminds me of when Ed Koch was running against Mayor Dinkins and then lost to Mayor Dinkins in the primary. They asked him, "Mr. Mayor, will he ever run again?" And he said, "No, the people have spoken and they must be punished."
That's a great line.
That's how I feel about New York right now. As an expat New Yorker who's not going to have to live under this guy but cares about the city, I grew up there. It's my home. I think back to first of all, I don't even know why Curtis Sliwa's in the race right now. He has no chance of winning, and he's basically electing Mondatti. He should get out just like Adams did. But you know, you look at the Andrew Cuomo, who is like a disgraced former governor who, you know, many New Yorkers, including our beloved Janice Dean, you know, literally blamed for killing their parents and grandparents. It reminds me of the governor's race when David Duke was the Republican nominee in New Orleans, and he was running against Edwards, who was the Democratic nominee, who was a convicted felon. And the slogan for Edwards was "Vote for the felon; it's important." that's how I feel about, you know, Andrew Cuomo. If I was I loathe Andrew Cuomo. I think he's one of the most loathsome politicians in America. I would pull the lever for Andrew Cuomo to stop Zoran Mondatti. You got to clear the field and, you know, let's vote for the guy who locked down the city during COVID and sent people with COVID into the nursing homes, because it's better than communism, which is literally what he is.
So he's, if you want to know what life's going to be like here for people like me that work in New York City who don't get to vote but have to pay the taxes, here's what President Trump says is going to happen. He's going to double the pain. Cut 11.
We have a communist who's 33 years old, doesn't know a damn thing. Practically, he's never worked a day in his life. And he sort of caught on, right? And I'm not going to send a lot of money to New York.
And he says it's like throwing it out the window. So it's going to be a double squeeze.
Yeah. Why would we subsidize communism? And look, he calls himself a democratic socialist. You know who else said that? The Democratic People's Republic of East Germany, Democratic Republic of North Korea. If you ever see the modifier "democratic" in front of socialism, it's a giveaway that the communist, whether it's a country or a person, the guy's a communist. And you know, if New York wants to elect that, this is the city where the 9/11 attack happened, where Islamic radicals flew planes into buildings and killed thousands of people in our midst, and we're going to elect a guy who couldn't bring himself on Martha's show to say that Hamas should not have any role in governing Gaza, which Hamas is the same movement as Al Qaeda. They have the same goals. There's no difference between Hamas and Al Qaeda. Hamas is not a Palestinian liberation statehood movement. They are the same ideology as Al Qaeda. They want to destroy all the Western designed states. They want to build a caliphate that goes from Spain to the Middle East. And we're going to elect a guy who can't even bring himself to condemn that. It's just appalling.
Mark, how does the template for what the president's pulled off so far, and we go over the details of some things that are getting derailed, but how does the template of that lead to what could happen in Ukraine?
Well, what he did what's very important to understand is that Biden, he rejected all of Biden's policies and reversed them. So Biden's policy was restrain Israel, withhold weapons, appease Iran. And he did the opposite. He armed Israel, he unleashed the IDF, and he obliterated the Iranian nuclear program. And that created the conditions that allowed him to do this peace plan, which the entire world rallied around. He didn't persuade Hamas to give up its weapons and to hand over the hostages. He forced them to do it by isolating them, by cutting off their patron, by inflicting financial and military pain on them. The same thing is true in Russia. Putin is never going to voluntarily come to the table. He's shown this. It's been 2 months since the Alaska summit, and what was supposed to happen was there was supposed to be a meeting with Zelensky, and then there'd be a tripartite meeting and a deal. And Putin not only has he refused to meet with Zelensky or meet his end of the bargain of the Alaska summit, he's escalated his attacks on Ukraine. He's sending drones into NATO countries. He's sending Russian fighter jets into NATO territory. He's escalated. And so you don't try and win a game of escalation dominance with Donald Trump. So the way to bring him to the table is to give the Ukrainians the Tomahawk cruise missiles to start inflicting pain on Russia the way he's inflicting pain on them. And you can crush their economy, crush their military, and then he'll have to come to the table.
Because they're going for the energy sector, and they're putting personal pain to the Russian people, and they're hurting him being able to literally fuel his military machine. At the same time, be able to bomb out drone factories. So they're not looking for innocent people in apartment buildings like the Russians are. So what you're saying, Mark, is show when Zelensky comes to town tomorrow, they've already had their military people here. NATO had a meeting two days ago. So they are NATO is buying these weapons, and they look to be setting up a legitimate missile defense system instead of a hodgepodge, whatever you got, give me. And they're looking to get a battle plan together. And when you show they're in for the long haul, let Vladimir Putin look around and check his bank account and wonder, wait a second, I was starting to break these guys. Now what?
So here's the thing. So Putin says it would be escalation for us to give Tomahawk cruise missiles to the Ukrainians. He has fired 2,400 cruise missiles into Ukraine, and he doesn't just target military sites. He targets schools. He targets hot children's hospitals. He targets shopping malls. So to give Ukraine the ability to respond in kind, except against military and industrial targets, is not escalation. It's proportional response. So this idea that this is escalatory is ridiculous, number one. Number two, if you give Ukraine the ability to do that, what it does is it takes – you can't reach all of the targets with drones, and you can't bring the payload you need to destroy them with drones. So if you give them a Tomahawk cruise missile, and they take out the Russian drone factory, they take out the Russian bomber bases. And also, by the way – you can take out their oil and natural gas production capability, which means you don't have to even put in sanctions or tariffs on China because you stop it at the source and start inflicting some real economic and military pain on Russia. Then Putin's going to sue for peace.
He's going to have to.
He'll have no choice.
Right. And the thing is, he could say, look, I gained this product. You know, they got off ramps. He is not interested in the off ramps. He was interested in making Trump look naive, but he's not. Trump's like, listen,
I'm going to force him to an off-ramp.
Yeah. So the off-ramp is you get to keep the land you got, and for no reason except for we just don't want a prolonged war in the area. But what you've done is you have alerted all of NATO that America, instead of begging you to fortify your defense, now you know you have to. We added two more great countries into NATO. Maybe Joe Biden gets credit for that, whatever it is, or the realities suck. And now people understand that a Russian invasion is not a theory. It's a reality if they're not ready to fight.
No, it's exactly right. And look, the reality is that Putin always threatens escalation. So Biden was terrified of escalation, right? Putin would say, "Oh, if you give them F-16s, I'll escalate." And Biden would quiver and quiver and quiver, and then eventually he'd do it, and the escalation would never materialize. He said, well, if you give them TACMs that can fire into Russia, well, then we'll escalate. The escalation never comes because Putin has never attacked a NATO country. He's only invaded non-NATO countries because he can't beat Ukraine. How the hell is he going to beat Poland? How is he going to beat the NATO alliance in a war? He'd be crushed. And so he's not going to do that. So, I think the only way to end this is to impose costs on Russia that are unacceptable to Putin.
And hopefully we get a battle plan Friday. It's amazing the way these two, Zelensky and Trump, are beginning to like each other. And Zelensky came out the other day and said that Donald Trump is much better for Ukraine than Joe Biden was. And he makes quicker decisions, first and foremost. Mark, lastly, the New York Times had a story today, not denied by the administration. The CIA is working strongly, if I could use the president's term, in Venezuela. not only are they blowing up boats, they are trying to pressure Maduro and get him out. He's an illegitimate leader of that country. He's destroyed it. He's killing people. And he's allowing China, Russia, and Iran to have a foothold in the hemisphere. And that's not okay.
No, it's not. I mean, this is the Monroe Doctrine.
How do you feel
this
about
our
it?
Hemisphere? I feel if Donald Trump wants to launch covert operations to bring down his regime, go for it. Look, one of the things that that Trump's national defense strategy is going to have is a focus on hemispheric security, on our security here at home, and having a dictator that is sending fentanyl into our country. I mean, truly, the fentanyl that's coming from Venezuela has killed more people than the 9/11 attacks have inside our country. It's like a foreign army coming into our country and killing our citizens. Trump is right to designate them a foreign terrorist organization, these cartels, and to take them out. And the solution is the best way to do it is to get rid of the regime.
Well, you know, that Fortress America, which a lot of podcasters were hoping Donald Trump would do, is not coming out. They don't like the fact that he's now looking at the reality and not looking at the reality and saying, I'm not giving Russia the benefit of the doubt. He doesn't like the fact that he was all in on Israel. And they don't like the fact that he's getting aggressive with an enemy in our region. What is your response to areas, parts of the Republican Party are not happy about that?
Well, first of all, those parts of the Republican Party represent a tiny fraction of the MAGA movement. If you look at every poll, and I've done multiple columns on this, MAGA voters are not isolationists. They are not. They want American leadership in the world. And when Trump ran in 2016, what did he say? He didn't say we need to pull back from the world. He said we're sick of losing. We want to win. And now look at the wins we're getting with Donald Trump. You know, why do you think you have peace in the Middle East? Because he killed Qasem Soleimani and he obliterated the Iranian nuclear program. If the isolationists had their way, none of that would have happened. So, you know, Donald Trump is not an isolationist. The MAGA movement is not isolationist. There's this handful of isolationists out there who have loud voices. They're loud mouths, but they don't represent anybody.
This is the first time, maybe since Teddy Roosevelt was president, that you had a leader address Central and South America. And this is comprehensive. Remember, the first move was Panama Canal and get China out of there. And now he's trying to take a big risk and help Argentina. And I think part of the deal with Argentina is you got to kick out China. I hope it is. But we didn't do that. One thing that bothers me, and went over with Dennis Ross a short time ago, we did not demand for recognition of Syria's leader that Russia get out. And now we have Syria's leader meeting in Russia, him promising all military relationships are sustained. Why is that? Why are we allowing Russia to get a foothold after they've killed so many innocent Syrians with barrel bombs? And now we allow this Al-Qaeda guy, who's not Assad, that we took a risk in recognizing, to go to Moscow and fortify relations.
Well, first of all, that could all be reversed with a stroke of a pen.
Let's
he better
it.
Be careful.
Yeah.
Donald Trump, the sanctions can be put right back on. He needs to make a decision. And to be perfectly honest with you, I wouldn't be betting my security on Vladimir Putin. He's got his hands tied up pretty tough in Ukraine, and it's going to get worse. I would not be making my bed with Vladimir Putin if I was the leader of Syria right now.
Mark, I hope the president invites you over for the meeting with Zelensky. It'll be sure to go well. All right.
I'll meet you there.
All right. Washington Post, his column, Trump forces Hamas to the table. He can do the same with Vladimir Putin. And now, you know, the rest of the story. Mark Thiessen, thank you.
I've heard that somewhere before.
I made it up right now. It's my phrase. How dare you? Back in a moment.
It's Brian Kilmeade. The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Well, some people have actually said I was the most qualified candidate ever to run for president.
I like the some people say. Very nice. But go ahead.
I'm just speaking fact.
Yeah.
She's out of her mind. She's had so many sycophants next to her. Her book tour is just an embarrassment, and she doesn't know it. She blames everybody but herself for the 107 days that she ran with over $1 billion, end up in deficit, with a lead after the convention. She got a nomination she didn't earn. She was able to have everyone whitewash her invisible 3.5 years of contributions to the Biden administration. Would have been a great opportunity for a capable vice president as a president just withered before her eyes. Instead, she's on a book tour, too good to be governor of California. It's actually a job you have to work for. Now she wants to be president, and she thinks this book is going to do it. And you have Kira Swisher come out and say, yeah, a lot of people say, of course, agreeing with her in the sarcastic way, that she's the most qualified person. Why? Because you were senator and attorney general and a vice president. By the way, if you want to look at resumes, much better resume for Joe Biden to ever run for president. You know, you look at George H.W. Bush, I'm pretty sure CIA director, congressman, war hero, or successful businessman who was vice president and then ran for president after 8 years as vice president, I'm pretty sure that's more qualified than Kamala Harris. Absolutely incredible. Who had run for president already and lost to Reagan. And Reagan said, "You're so good, I want you to run with me." So, I mean, she says it's the closest election ever. That's not true. She's the most qualified. That's not true. She did a good job. I know that's not true. Coming up next, he was the former director of the Mossad, the most respected intelligence agency in the world. Yossi Cohen is going to be our guest next, and we're going to be on Zoom so you can watch it. So if you're on your iPhone, you can watch the whole interview.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
We're not permitted to spy on the Israelis. We're not permitted. The potential for blowback is outrageous. Can you imagine if we spied on the Israelis and got caught? Every member of Congress would be demanding the CIA director's head.
Do you think that we really don't spy on the Israelis?
Yes. That was verboten when I was there.
I was surprised to hear you say that in that interview, because I figured it's this gentleman's game, so to speak.
Mm-mm. With most other places, post 9/11, you know, we developed the Five Eyes and we don't spy on each other in the Five Eyes. And of course, we have very, very close relationships with other countries. Not a ton, but a lot. But the Israelis are special. Yeah, we do not spy on the Israelis.
How does the Mossad feel about that? Is that in fact true? Why don't we ask the former director of the Mossad, Yossi Cohen, joins us now. Yossi, that was John Kirikou. John was the head of the CIA counterterrorism operation in Pakistan. He led the raid that captured Abu Zubaydah, blew the whistle on the CIA enhanced interrogation program. Was he right? Is it forbidden, as far as you know, for us to spy on you guys?
Well, I hope he's right. I mean, first, thank you very much for having me in your show. That's an amazing thing, an amazing show. I mean, and thank you very much for hosting me. Well, I hope this is the case. I mean, I know that for sure. I mean, Israelis do not spy in the USA. We do not recruit Americans. We do not spy in the USA, not entirely. I mean, we don't do that. So I hope that America reciprocate. I don't know. I don't know that for sure, but I hope this is the case.
I mean, what I've seen for the Mossad being able to pull off over, you know, my lifetime, over the last 15, 20 years, has been somewhat just astounding, but you're a part of that. Tell me how you got into it.
How did I get into the Mossad in the first place?
Yep.
Well, when I resigned from the army, I was a commander in the first Lebanon War in 1982. That was like 43 years ago. When I resigned from the army, I left for my first studies in a British college in London, and I was spotted there by the Mossad. I mean, my first few months in London, I was spotted by the Mossad, and I'd been engaged and approached by them. And they said something like, not very clear, but we are the Prime Minister's office, Ministry of Defense, stuff like that, and we want to offer you a job. I didn't know what is it all about, but I was very much interested in learning more or listening to them. And my first visit to Israel, I've engaged with the office, like Prime Minister's office or any other cover name that they have used. And I realized that they are the mighty Mossad at the time. I was very much interested in doing it. And a few months later, I've started my exams, I mean, to make sure that I fit in. And a year later, I mean, after the exams were completed, I started my operational courses already. So in 1983, wow. I am a part of the Mossad. I mean, it took me 2.5 years to be certified as an operative. But after a very long, tough 2.5 years, I was eventually there.
And I guess one of the stories is when you become a Mossad agent, you were known as Y, I guess, you kind of lose your identity. You could just disappear. You couldn't tell anyone you're involved in it, correct?
Correct.
So what have those years been like? I mean, it must have been really hard. You're sacrificing your personal life for the future of Israel.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, this is what you do. First, I mean, it has to be precisely defined in between what we do and what we don't do. We do not work inside the state of Israel. All right. So everything that operationally Mossad is doing is outside of Israel. So it's a kind of very risky job. I mean, we go all over to the Middle East, we go all over to countries, and we operate in order to either recruit people or to conduct special operations to make sure that the state of Israel will be safer. I mean, not only the state of Israel, somehow the world will be safer. So yes, you do sacrifice a lot. I mean, you do sacrifice your personal life, and you are willing to sacrifice your entire life, either your freedom or your life, literally. So this is something that we do on day-to-day basis.
So we watched how they infiltrated, Mossad had infiltrated Iran prior to the attacks, watched as the Mossad had pulled off the most brilliant pager attack, followed up by the walkie-talkie attack over in Lebanon. And I'm wondering, and also the capture of all those documents proving that Iran had a nuclear program. You've took it out of Iran and set it up in Israel. You were part of that operation, it seems. And it just seems like there's nothing you guys can't do. Can you bring us inside that operation to show the world what Iran was really up to?
Well, I mean, it was very interesting times. I mean, it was like in 2015, in July precisely, I mean, the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, what we call the Iranian nuclear deal, was signed between the powers, USA, China, Russia, and the three Europeans, I mean, backed by the IAEA in Vienna, the International Atomic Agency. And the agreement was signed under the Democratic Obama's administration. I mean, we have tried our utmost. I was like the prime negotiator for the State of Israel, working together with the White House and the others to make sure that this agreement will not be signed the way the powers wanted it, but eventually it was signed. And in 2016, I am now the director of the Mossad, and we start to see something very weird happening in Iran after the agreement was signed. And they've started to collect materials from all over the countries in a very discreet manner. The one who led that job or discreet job was Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, rest in peace. I mean, since then, I mean, he died, right? But according to former reports in a special op inside Iran. But prior to that, he gathered all these kind of materials in a very distant area inside Tehran, but a very distant area from the center of Tehran, an area that would not be declared or notified as part of the administration or part of the regime. And we wondered, what is it? So the beginning of January 2016, my first days at the Mossad, we've learned that he's doing something weird. And I have ordered my people then not to lose the eye from the ball. I mean, to make sure that we know everything that he does and to make sure that we know where is it going to. And with the minute we knew when it lands and the minute they have been satisfied with the collection entirely from the entire state into this warehouse in Tehran, we breached in and we took half a ton of materials to Israel. I mean, in between the decision and the operation, Brian, it took us 2 years.
Wow.
Right? I mean, 2016, we took the decision. In January 2018, we've actually operated dozens of operatives, I mean, together inside this warehouse. We had like a few hours to sneak in, to steal what we need, because there were three huge containers with a lot of materials. So we had to control what we bring home and what we don't need to bring home. And then, you know, by 7 o'clock in the morning, the entire country was after us. I mean, the kind of pursuit that started, we believe, 10,000 policemen and circuit police, and all borders were totally closed. I mean, that's at sea borders and aerial borders. Everything was totally controlled and sealed. So, but we planned that and we knew that this is going to happen. So we left the materials inside Iran for a while. And then not by FedEx or DHL, I mean, we're brought back to Israel.
Understood. You'll leave that up to mystery. But it just goes to show you, you had to show the world the truth, because the world was signing off on Iran's diabolical program. So you had to get it out and prove to everyone. It's not my opinion. This is the fact. This is what they're really working on, making a mockery of the worst deal ever, which thankfully President Trump ripped up the first time. What about the pager?
Absolutely right.
Yeah, right. And so what about the pager
Absolutely
operation?
Right.
How long was that in planning, do you know?
Well, I mean, we've understood that there, because of the use of technologies by our enemies, We have realized in the beginning of the 2000s, 2004 or so, that we can be, or we should be, part of their supply chain. Simple as that. I mean, it's not as simple as that, but we have decided to be part of the supply chain of part of the enemies. I mean, part of the groups of the enemies that we see that are conducting a discreet purchase of the things that they need. Because when an organization like a terror organization like Hezbollah is buying things, I mean, you can't really buy it, you know, Amazon or whatever, I mean, or eBay, yeah, and get what it needs, because part of the materials are not, are forbidden, and he cannot really purchase that. So what we did is we have kind of conducted ourselves to be their official providers. I mean, we had to, of course, not say, I'm not telling them that we're Israelis, but the first equipment that we eventually sold to Hezbollah undercover, not knowing, of course, that we are either neither Mossad nor Israel, of course, was already operating in 2006, the second Lebanon War. And since then, we're not caught, thank God. And since then, we are selling again and again and again equipments, not only to them, right, but to other, let's say, organizations or countries that we are interested in either three things. One is intelligence, two, location, and three, to disrupt. So disruption could be either a little bomb inside, little explosive things inside, or any other manner, like it would stop operating or will tell us where it is and what do they do with it.
So you, they didn't want cell phones, so they want to be tracked. So they were going to use pagers. They're going to be smarter than you. But you guys put explosive devices in those pagers. They always had to keep them on because they never knew when Hezbollah would come call it, and they had to do some terror operation, usually against Israel. And then the explosion happened and the follow-up with the walkie-talkies, and it began became clear that the Mossad had laid the groundwork to take out the world's number one terror group, and that's Hezbollah. And they have not recovered. And Nasrallah later would be dead because you were able to track his every movement. So the Mossad has pulled off incredible things. I want to play another cut.
Thank
from
you.
Yeah, I just can't get my head around it. No one else can. And I think the rest of the world's in awe. John Curacao, though, is critical. He's a former head of the CIA counterterror operations, I mentioned. Listen to him. Cut 37.
Again, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like you'd be hard-pressed to argue with the fact that they are really, really good.
Best in the world. My experience is universally negative. Universally negative. I've never had a positive encounter with Mossad. I have never met a CIA officer who has had a positive encounter with Mossad. Because the Mossad doesn't give two shits what you think or what you are trying to focus on in your job. They care only about Israel. And if that means shoving their fists up your ass or trying to recruit you or telling you to go f*** yourself while they try to recruit, you know, the guy sitting next to you or the guy in the defense contractor's office, they don't care what you think of them. Because for them, it's an issue of survival.
I don't know if you're going to, if you disagree with anything he said, right?
I disagree with everything he said. Yeah. Well, I don't know the guy, by the way. I've never worked with him or never met with him, or probably if I did, I don't remember the name. But you know what? When I finished my time after long 5.5 years, and I'd been working with four different directors of the CIA, I started with John Brennan, who was under Obama. Then Mike Pompeo took over. Then Gina Haspel, his deputy, took over when Mike was nominated to be Secretary of State. Then again, Bill Burns with the Democrats under Biden. And I know them all, and I respect them all. And the level of cooperation that I had with the CIA as director of the Mossad, deputy director of the Mossad, and you know what? Somehow, behind the scene, the discrete operations that we've conducted together maybe brought them to the point that I, in my last days, in my time, was invited to Washington, D.C., and I was awarded by the John Tenet Award, given to me by the head of the CIA, reflecting exactly the wonderful cooperation that we had with the State of Israel and with the Mossad precisely.
I got one more question for you. As impressive as would, if you were in charge of the Mossad, would October 7th have happened? How could Israel have been so blindsided by people secretly doing drills and learning how to hang glide for them to pull off such a devastating attack that killed so many and took over 200 hostages?
Right. I think, first, Mossad is not dealing with Palestinian story whatsoever. We're not involved in either Judea and Samarra, as what we call the West Bank, or in Gaza Strip, unfortunately so. I think that you can see the differences in the level, as you have mentioned. I mean, what we can do inside Iran, which is far away. I mean, we don't share any border with Iran. I mean, it's hard to get in and to get out, or Iraq, or Syria, or other nations that we had to operate in. And the same way that we've infiltrated, I mean, in between a tougher organization called, as you mentioned correctly, I mean, Hezbollah. Now, Mossad is not dealing with Gaza Strip, and I say again, unfortunately. And, you know, at the national level of the discrete things that you don't see on the national level history is that we do have two lines of defense. The first line of defense is the intelligence line of defense. And this one collapsed because we didn't have enough intelligence, blankly. I mean, in my book that I published recently in the USA too, The Sword of Freedom, I mean, you can read and learn about my willing, about my wishes to be part of the battle in Gaza Strip. I offered my Mossad services to the prime minister and to my counterparts inside Israel, head of our Shin Bet, the like equivalent to the FBI, head of the military intelligence inside the Israeli IDF, inside IDF. So, and I was kicked out. I mean, I was not like welcomed with our whatever troops, operatives, and methodologists. Why? Because they claimed wrongly that they have enough intelligence and they don't really need us. And this line of defense collapsed completely. I mean, we didn't see that. It's not a small operation that Hamas has conducted, right?
Yep,
it's not big. Yeah, it's huge. 1,500, maybe 3,000 people working together in one day. That's a big, big, big thing.
Yossi Cohen, I'm just in awe of your career and your accomplishments and what you've done to make Israel one of the most formidable militaries and intelligence operations, and if not the most in the world, and your contributions. I need another 3 hours with you, and I still wouldn't get the whole story. Hopefully we can talk again.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for having me again.
You got it. Back in a moment.
You're with Brian Kilmeade.
It's Will Tane Country. Watch it live at noon Eastern Monday through Thursday at foxnews.com or on the Fox News YouTube channel. And don't miss the show. Listen and follow the podcast 5 days a week at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you download your favorite podcasts.
Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
The problem, respectfully, is that your husband is the least qualified Department of Health and Human Services head that we've had in history.
I think that's a very dangerous. Why is he less qualified than an economist?
I think that he is less qualified.
He has spent his career studying toxins, studying people's health, fighting for one guy who was using Roundup for his job.
He has also spread a lot of misinformation, a lot of chaos, a lot of confusion.
So that is The View, and that's what happens when you're the wife of RFK Jr., want to sell a book and go on The View. I thought she did a great job defending her husband, considering she was said, I was in the Hollywood bubble for the longest time, just trying to get the next acting job, was called catapulted into this family, Democratic family, and now I find myself surrounded by Republicans, and she seems thrilled by it. I mean that. And she talks about there are spouses now, spouses groups of politicians, and RFK has been under scrutiny, but man, he's the second most popular member of the MAGA movement, and I'm not saying he signs on to any or all of the president's policies, but he likes being around him, and the president's done exactly what he promised, giving him the opportunity at HHS to change things, especially what you eat, and make the CDC accountable, especially after we witnessed they weren't during the pandemic. Has every move been great? No, it hasn't. But I like the team he surrounded himself with, and I love the fact that his wife is out there sticking up for him, knowing that she's not born a Republican or a politician. Brian Kilmeade.
News Radio Studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi everyone, so glad you're there. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show coming to you from Midtown Manhattan, heard around the country, around the world. It's going to be a big hour. We got Zvika Klein standing by, editor-in-chief of the Jerusalem Post. Josh Krasauer at the bottom of the hour, Fox News's radio political analyst, editor-in-chief of the Jewish Insider. We're going to go inside what's happening in Gaza, and speculation about phase two is well underway as we wait for 19 more bodies to emerge. Meanwhile, just a quick note, Fox Nation Patriot Awards 2025, tickets are going fast at the Tiller Center on Long Island for the performing arts. FoxNation.com/Patriot Awards to buy tickets. It'll be November 6th at 8 o'clock. We'll be presenting, and of course, Fox and Friends is going to be live there. You can watch it, the five, you can buy tickets for it, and there'll be a meet and greet too. All extras you can get besides going to the show, which is going to be full of huge names. So let's get to the big three.
Number three.
They are refusing to do their job. They're grasping for straws. They're trying to make this about political tabloids and political intrigue and horse races, exactly the kinds of things that people are sick of in this country.
Really? Thanks, AOC. Day 16 of the shutdown. Tempers flare and Democratic Socialists emerge as the leaders of their party. That is real bad news for the party. I'll explain.
Number two.
The biggest challenge is getting Hamas out of control of Gaza, and that's looking actually as elusive as ever. And a big question is, how much capital is Trump going to spend? If Hamas continues to take power, it's going to take buy-in from the Arab allies to really push them out.
That is true, Josh. Gaza peace deal in the making. They're doing some in-game adjustments as Hamas refuses to put down their weapons and return 19 bodies of Israelis that they murdered. We got the latest.
Number one.
Would you give President Trump credit or not? To any extent, credit or not?
I think it's too early to do so.
Too early to say.
But if it proves to be something that is lasting, something that is durable, then I think that's where you give credit.
Getting out 20 hostages isn't good enough for Zohran Mamdani, the unaccomplished 33-year-old mayoral candidate. Debate night for the New York City mayor's race. And the world is watching as the front runner Zohran Mamdani sits down with Fox and smiled his way through his wacky policies that made no sense. Zvika, welcome back to the Brian Kilmeade Show. What is life like right now in Jerusalem?
Hi, Brian. How are you?
Good.
Life is, it feels like it's getting back to normal, in a sense. It's not totally back to normal yet, but, you know, we had some news this week.
Yes, you did. First off, just a question. In the north, with the Hezbollah threat decreased, have people moved back into their homes?
So that's been already for a while. The homes, except for the homes that were destroyed, and that will take a while. But yeah, but people have moved back, and they see a lot less of a threat there. Definitely.
So no more rockets from Hamas, but you can't say Hamas is in your rearview mirror. First off, how did you view the phase one of this deal?
So, I mean, I think, first of all, it was amazing accomplishment. You know, it's not something that was that people thought would actually happen. You know, many people doubted it, and he made it work. We're still waiting to see what's with the bodies of the remaining 19 hostages. But the fact that the 20 remaining live hostages have been released is just a breath of fresh air for Israelis. Like, people are so happy. Like, they're the biggest celebrities that the country's had, you know, because people have been following them and their families for 2 years. So, you know, they went through a lot, but people are just starting to see some sort of an end, which is important.
You put Donald Trump's likeness, his profile, on the cover, a silhouette on the cover of the Jerusalem Post. Why?
So we did that. It was a week ago when they announced, you know, that this deal was actually signed or happening. And we published the silhouette with pictures of all the hostages that were, you know, remaining, because he made it happen. And, you know, you have to say thanks when it's due. And it was definitely something that he deserved.
Anthony Blinken, the former Secretary of State, said, well, this was our plan. We had it first. He just executed our plan. I don't believe that, but I was curious, as you, editor-in-chief of the Jerusalem Post, Zvika, what do you say?
So, Brian, I think, obviously, there are certain things that are similar, but Trump took a broader approach to this. The fact that we're seeing Egypt and Qatar pressure Hamas like we've never seen Turkey. Them do before. And Turkey, yeah, publicly. Now, listen, am I a big Erdogan supporter? No. But you know, they're pressuring Hamas to end with this war and to move on and you know, to disarm, etc. So and seeing these Muslim states publicly also say so, not just in behind closed doors, but actually say it straightforward, like this needs to end, is something that probably wouldn't happen if, I mean, it definitely wouldn't happen if you know, the elections would end differently, the presidential elections. So,
I mean,
you know,
yeah, it was the number one, I think, Zvika, I think it was the fact that the president said, I'm going to support Israel on the offensive. No hedging, yeah. No limiting. I'm going to support. At the same time, he has relationships with the Gulf states. And I know it wasn't too popular when he was in visit Saudi Arabia and Qatar and UAE and didn't end up in Israel. But he said,
right.
I know we're friends with Netanyahu and I are fine. I'm not. That's not what this trip's about. And everyone said, oh, that's a bad message.
I think I even asked you back then. I think either you interviewed me or I texted you and I said, Brian, like, are we okay? Is Israel, like, are we okay? Is he ignoring us? You know what I'm saying? Because he was in the region and he didn't come to Israel. So Israelis were for a moment, they were like, wait, did he like, why is he not visiting? You know? So I think that definitely made things happen.
It fortified the relationship between the other Gulf states. Now here's the biggest test. So we see the execution of 33 so-called collaborators as Hamas tries to reestablish itself with, we think, 7,000 more fighters. I'm also seeing videos of different clans saying to Hamas, essentially, bring it on. And those are the ones that I think Israel has identified as clans they can work with. So now, logically, I would love to see the Arab nations of Egypt, Turkey, you know, Qatar, stand up and go, hey, Hamas, decommission your weapons, stand down. And enough, no more executions. Does all of that have to come from us? And have you heard anything from those countries?
I haven't yet heard from those countries on this topic. Those clans, again, those clans are, Israel's working with them, you know, under the radar. Not, you know, it's like, it's your enemy's worst enemy, yeah. Right? That's what it is. It's not like peaceful forces. The problem is, you know, these countries are, you know, aren't willing to put their own soldiers there because they know what chaos it is. So it's a very big question of how you could actually implement it. And it's a really big deal because no one wants to get near that area. You know, I spoke to people, you know, to very senior people in the Gulf, and they're like, we're not sending people there. Like, we'll pay. We'll pay someone, you know. But
it can't be UN. And because you'll have another UNIFIL situations where they just sell out to the terror group. Number two is, we know Indonesia said it will do it. And we know it's going to be $50 billion minimum to redo Gaza, get it up and running again. You got to destroy the rest of the tunnels. And we got to put in troops that Hamas would be afraid to take a shot at. So Egypt would fill that bill. Doha, Qatar would fill that bill. But have they rejected that premise?
No, they haven't rejected the premise yet, and I think there will be countries that would volunteer and actually take part in this. But it's something that also takes a while, and you know, President Trump doesn't have patience. He wanted this to happen, and he launched it. And his you know, one thing I think Israelis are just worried about is we want him to keep on. Being interested, right? Like, don't just like look at this as a success and move on to another conflict. No, we still need the support.
Here's Ambassador Mike Waltz with me this morning on what needs to happen now after the executions on camera, not caught, but they wanted it. They wanted everyone to see this. Cut 36.
One thing to understand is some of these countries need an international mandate, like through the UN, to contribute the troops. They need and want it according to their local laws or their constitution.
And
that's where we come in. We're working through all of those pieces right now as we speak. So
he said the Arab world, Middle East countries really count on the UN. And he's a UN ambassador. And, you know, the U.S. and Israel are very dissatisfied with the UN. But great potential.
That's
very, very poor result. So he's saying that now they're coming to the UN. They want that stamp, that UN stamp. So that's what Waltz has got to do. But it can't be UN white helmet guys.
Right. The same thing is, by the way, you know, Hamas wants the UN to distribute the aid because they want it for themselves, and not, you know, the GHF, the humanitarian foundation that was established by the United States and Israel. So I think, yeah, we can't have it be the UN. And luckily, President Trump is not satisfied with the UN, so it would support us on that.
So you wrote a story about the release of the Berman twins from Hamas captivity is a miracle few will understand. Do you want to give us an idea what you mean?
Yeah, so I wrote this as a father of twins. I have twin boys. And there were a number of cases throughout this war where there were hostages who were twins of the same sex, even. Like, it was boys that were kidnapped and girls that were kidnapped, and they were separated and brought back together. And I said, it was a very dramatic statement that I, in my opinion, was, you know, as an Israeli, like Americans wouldn't necessarily understand it. I would prefer to have both of my sons being kidnapped together, you know, as twins, than one of them, because separating them is such a terrible situation. But I think these twins who were they were both kidnapped, but they were held separately most of the time, will be able to heal together. Like, they were at the hospital and they asked to stay in the same room. Like, they could have got their own room. And I think it's a special connection there. And I'm actually waiting to hear their story.
Okay, to get it. So 19 bodies left. They have to turn them over, but they said they're going to need special equipment, Hamas, to get to them. Do you believe that?
Right. I believe it on a certain amount of that 19, of those 19 bodies. I think there are others that they actually will be able to deal with. It's really, you know, it's really an issue of putting a bit more pressure. That's what, again, Israeli sources are saying. But you know, I think they definitely probably need that equipment because we bombed the hell out of that place, and you know, there's a lot of rubble.
This looks like an earthquake and a tornado and a tsunami all at once, and it would be tough to rebuild. But if they're shooting at you, it's not going to be rebuilt. I mean,
right.
What is the sense inside Israel? I mean, there's 7,000 fighters now without the protection of hostages. So this, I know there's a big sentiment in Israel right now. Let's just go in and wipe them out. That's not as because they're not already not fulfilling the deal.
Right.
What's the public sentiment like as we watch them kill people that Israel maybe have felt comfortable dealing with, not using them as informants, but dealing with possible governorship. So what is the sentiment in Israel about that, about taking action themselves again?
So I would say the sentiment would be, if these bodies are not given to Israel, because they said they could return these bodies. That's part of the deal, right? They signed the deal, saying a number of people, right? So if they don't actually abide to their side of the deal, there would be a really big amount of Israelis that would say, as you said, go in, wipe them out, because now we don't have the constraints of the living hostages. And that was a big deal. You know, it was a very big humanitarian issue where the IDF, even though, you know, the liberal or progressive media sees Israel as an aggressor, actually was very careful during the war there.
All right, Zvika, it's going to be an interesting time in Jerusalem. People are going to keep their eye on it because we want to see if they can get to the reconstruction part. And then, of course, in the perfect world, in come the Abraham Accords. And also to keep an eye on Hezbollah. How much is Hezbollah done? What is left of Hezbollah?
Not a lot, actually. Hezbollah is a lot less of a threat than Hamas. I mean,
could Lebanon take control of their country again?
Not yet, but Israel's intelligence and presence, presence and IDF presence there was so deep that it allowed, you know, for Israel to do so many truly amazing things there. And Gaza was a failure in that sense. It took a really long time. 2 years is a very long time to have that battle and that war.
Absolutely. Zvika, we'll stay in touch. It's a very exciting time in Jerusalem, and hopefully the good times roll now and peace breaks out everywhere. Zvika Klein.
Thank you, Brian.
You got it. Editor-in-chief of the Jerusalem Post. Thanks so much. All right, when we come back, I want to take your calls for the first time, 1-866-408-7669. I can only get a few, but I want to get to them because then Josh Trash Hour on the other side. Don't forget, Sunday, One Nation queuing up a big show, includes Eric Trump and Senator Tom Cotton. Don't move.
This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen, made for your brain.
We're going to do everything that we can to bring an end to this terrible shutdown, which is hurting you and which is hurting a million federal employees and millions of people who use federal services. But also, we have got to be cognizant that if Trump wins this fight, our healthcare system could well collapse, and tens of thousands of people could die every single year.
He's never done anything worthwhile. But yesterday he was at a town hall with his protege AOC, talking about how the two most powerful Democrats in the country are socialists, and if you want a future in that party, be a socialist. Scary for the country, and even scarier for the party's future, in my view. Howard, I'm listening on Coyle in Omaha, Nebraska. Hey, Howard.
Hey, Brian, with government shutdown and no King's rally, Democrats are trying to say Republicans don't care even about your health care. Republicans should flip the script, seize the initiative. Trump should address the nation, promise to set up a bipartisan commission, take other steps, and then follow up with a conservative health plan, health care plan, which is long overdue.
I know, but they're not even close to doing that, Howard. They're not even working on it because they're stuck with Obamacare. They didn't have the votes. Remember that with McCain? And out of everything the president's doing, I don't think he's bringing this up because it looks like Obamacare is unfixable. They just keep throwing money at it. Stephen, listening on WLAD in Bethel, Connecticut. Stephen.
Yes, good morning, Brian. And thank you for your wonderful topics and everything. On this matter, I'm just curious. How many illegal aliens, pregnancies, or women having babies in this country this past year? We're born in hospitals or on the streets.
I'm just curious
about that.
They're all American citizens until the Supreme Court can make a ruling on birthright citizenship. All those kids born from illegals are American citizens. And then they work it out some way, somehow, that their parents become citizens, and it's all a scam. That's not how the Constitution was written. That's not how immigration was intended. And I think Democrats realize that, too. Why blow up our system? It was put together, the birthright citizenship, because of slavery and the aftermath. Brian Kilmeade Show. Josh, next.
The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
There is a real possibility that this war could pick back up again. Do you anticipate that happening?
Hamas will be forced to comply, whether it's going to happen through the pressure of Qatar, Egypt, and our other allies, Turkey in the region, who, again, the president, through just his sheer force of personality, has brought this coalition together to put the diplomatic pressure on Hamas. But if that's not going to work, the military option has always been on the table. I wouldn't look at it as a return to war. I would look at it as carrying out this plan, which has always demanded that Hamas must disarm. And again, this coalition is in agreement on one thing, which is that Hamas has no future in Gaza.
That's Eli Kohanan, who was the former State Department Deputy Special Envoy under President Trump, who knows the region well. Josh Krasauer joins us now, Fox News Radio political analyst and editor-in-chief of the Jewish Insider. Josh, so how would you talk about these last couple of days, really disturbing video emerging of Hamas executing people in Gaza while still waiting by the torturous place of 19 more bodies to emerge? How fragile is this peace deal for you in your mind?
Well, look, Brian, it's important to separate the remarkable achievement that President Trump achieved when it comes to getting the hostages back and obviously a ceasefire and pause in the fighting and doing it on good security terms for Israel. Like, no one ever thought in Israel that they could get the hostages back without having to essentially leave Gaza and make their security situation a little more vulnerable. So major achievement there. I think that often gets conflated with a lot of the other points in the 20-point plan that involve Hamas being ousted from Gaza and imposing a moderate technocratic governance that with the help of Arab allies and other countries. And that is looking really challenging. I mean, that is, you know, the images of when God, I mean, this tells you everything about Hamas being the evil terrorist group that they are. The second that they got back control of some of the territory, they ended up, you know, executing Palestinians they suspected as, you know, helping out Israel. That's how evil and terroristic the entity is. And that is why everyone worth their salt was saying Hamas cannot be in charge of Gaza. But the challenge is, how do you know, it takes military effort or it takes a really muscular diplomacy to push them out. And it doesn't look right now, at least from my vantage point, that the Arab countries that were very supportive of this deal are necessarily doing the spending the capital to do so. And it remains a question on how attuned President Trump will be, you know, going forward to ensuring that some of the points in that 20-point plan actually get imposed. But that's the challenging part. I think a really difficult diplomacy of getting the hostages back and doing it on terms that are favorable to Israel and its allies, very important. But the harder part is actually getting Gaza back in governed. And that, by the way, Brian, that's been the story of the Palestinian experience. They never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity, and their leadership has been endorsing terrorism and not been able to build the infrastructure of a governing state.
Yeah, I want you to hear Dasha Burns last night on a special report for Politico, Cut 34.
White House officials held a call today on background about this issue, and they sounded optimistic that things were proceeding as they wanted them to. They disagreed with Netanyahu and Israel's characterization that Hamas is reneging on the agreement because they're being a little bit slower than they would like in returning those deceased hostages. They acknowledge that this is really complicated, and Politico's just reported that Indonesia, Azerbaijan, and Pakistan are talking about potentially sending troops in.
So that's a good group. They just got to be the troops that Hamas could be afraid to shoot,
right?
I mean, and aggravated. That would understand that they'd have an enforcement. It wouldn't be a UNIFIL. It wouldn't be a UNRWA group, right, or any UN group.
So I'll believe it when I see it. When you have Arab states that actually send in troops to the Gaza Strip and risk their lives.
So you doubt it?
Part of the plan. That's part of the deal, right? So that is, but the question is, you often hear, especially in all these Arab capitals, promises, but, and this has been talked about, Brian, for some time, even before the deal, like the way to solve the issue in Gaza is to actually have Arabs having a little more, you know, having a little more muscle in imposing a settlement on kicking Hamas out. But I know there's a lot of optimism from Jared Kushner and from the negotiators, who, by the way, just accomplished this remarkable
20 hostages
deal.
20 hostages.
Yeah, I mean that is just a remarkable accomplishment. But it may be even tougher to oust Hamas. That's always been the sticking point. Hamas is not willingly going to leave, and it's going to take some kind of force or muscular diplomacy to push them out.
All right, so I want to talk about today's mayoral debate. I know it's a New York story, but it's a national story when Mondami, Cuomo, and Sliwa go at it. And Mondami and Cuomo, Cuomo's looked at as the one with the legitimate shot of beating him, still trailing by about 13 points. Listen to what he was saying about Netanyahu yesterday. And I know he's not going to set foreign policy, but Netanyahu will come here for the UN. Cut 3.
You have said that you would arrest Netanyahu if he came to the United States. You've been very outspoken in your criticism of him. Do you stand by that? You would arrest him if he came here, if you were mayor?
I've said that this is a city that believes in international law, and this is a city that wants to uplift and uphold those beliefs.
United States doesn't stand by the International Criminal Court.
It hasn't signed the treaty for the International Criminal Court. The International Criminal Court, however, has issued a warrant for the arrest of Benjamin Netanyahu.
But what grounds in the United States could you arrest him on?
As it has for Vladimir Putin. I've said that I believe that we should uphold arrest warrants by the International Criminal Court, and that you should do so only in abiding with all of the laws in front of us. I'm not going to make a new law.
What's he even talking about? So now New York City has their own laws different from our foreign policy?
Yeah, look, a lot of points. Number one, it's just morally backwards to equate Benjamin Netanyahu, the democratically elected leader of a close U.S. ally, to Vladimir Putin. I mean, that's the kind of worldview that Mondani has.
Well, the International Criminal Court doesn't disseminate, as you know.
Well, that tells you. That's why we don't. That's why the U.S. doesn't recognize the International Criminal Court for those very reasons. But that's point number one.
Don't tell that to George Clooney's wife.
Right. Well, I thought Martha did a really, really tough interview with Mondani, and it was really notable that he actually spoke to the camera about how he was apologizing for his comments about the police and defunding the police and calling them racist. He does not, but he does not compromise. He does not give an inch on his very radical views towards Israel, towards, you know, fighting anti-Semitism in the city, recognizing Hamas as a terrorist group. I mean, you saw the exchange where she talked about what's going on in the news, where Hamas is killing Palestinians, which he's, you know, tried to pivot away from and ignore the question. But it makes you raise the issue of why is it so hard for someone like Mamdani to attack Hamas or to say that they're a terrorist group and to understand the difference between a terrorist group and, yeah, and the Democratic State of Israel, right? So that is why, by the way, he's leading in the polls, but he's only polling around 45%. Most, you know, Eric Adams won with over 70% of the vote. Usually, if you're a Democrat in New York, you win overwhelmingly. There is a sizable, if you look at the Quinnipiac poll, over half, if you combine Sliwa and Cuomo, over half of the New York City electorate won't vote for Mamdani. Problem is, it's divided two ways, and that's part of that's why Mamdani is the favorite to win. But there's a lot of Democrats, moderate Democrats, and certainly independents and Republicans that just can't stomach the guy.
So Hakeem Jeffries and Senator Schumer, radio silent, no endorsement. Gillibrand, no endorsement, no condemnation. You know, you have people like Swazi say, not my cup of tea, and Lauren Gill and Congress, Democratic Congress people, more moderate. But listen to AOC, cut 15.
You endorsed Doron Mamdani in the New York City mayoral race, but several prominent Democrats, including Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, have not yet endorsed him. What do you believe this says about the current divide between the progressive and establishment wings of the Democratic Party? And what effect do you think this has on party unity?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I have stated this for quite some time, which is that Democrats have primaries for a reason. We may have our differences amongst one another within the party. Some may be more conservative, some may be more liberal, or any other number of differences. That's what we have primaries for. I believe in endorsing the nominee of the party after a primary has resolved itself.
And I'm not going to play you the rest of the soundbite because it's painful, but she does say, look, did you think I want to endorse a moderate? But if the moderate gets a nomination, I will endorse them. But there's a huge divide here, isn't there?
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, it's very unusual for the leaders in, you know, at least the congressional wing of the party, and Chuck Schumer and Hakeem Jeffries, not to mention Kirsten Gillibrand as well, not to endorse the party's mayoral nominee. You mentioned Gillen and Swazi. They are actually anti-Mamdani. They said they're never Mamdani. They're never going to support him. But the problem is that, you know, it's easy to not take sides or to the credit of Swazi and Gillen to actually speak out about the guy being way out of the mainstream and being a radical. But ultimately, no one's really organizing for Cuomo. I mean, you have an alternative for Democrats on the ballot in Andrew Cuomo. Maybe he's not everyone's cup of tea, but they're not actually taking the steps to actually supporting the other alternative. And ultimately, that makes it seem much more political than principled, in that, you know, Chuck Schumer doesn't want the taint of Mamdani's mayoralty, if he's elected, to spread to other New York Democrats or other Democrats across the country. This guy obviously is far to the left of most other Democrats. Trump and Republicans know that this could create a lot of political problems for the party, that this guy's going to reflect on their national brand. And that's what they're worried about. They don't want to be seen as connected to a guy who, especially if he governs the way he talks, could lead to crises in the city and lead to real problems for New York Democrats and beyond.
Hey, Josh, the governor's race goes heavily to Stefanik, has a much better chance Mamdani wins, because people will see this horror show in New York City. And Stefanik is so competent and so strong for a Republican. I don't care, Republican or Democrat. She's a great politician and really knows the issues and knows New York. And they know her. When her name recognition goes up further, and Hochul, to me, is so beatable. Zeldin proved that. How do you feel Mamdani's win affects the governor's race next year?
Well, look, a lot of it is how he governs. Like, if there are a lot of business leaders in the city that are trying to, I think, convince themselves that he's going to be more pragmatic than his rhetoric in the past has indicated. If that's the case, you know, maybe the political impact is a little more limited. I remember the 2022 midterms when Democrats actually did quite well, but they lost badly in New York across all these New York races, including Lee Zeldin almost becoming governor, because crime immigration and quality of life issues were such a problem under Democratic leadership that Republicans just really ran the table throughout the state. And if Mamdani governs as he's campaigned, and the crime goes up and the quality of life goes down, as a lot of people fear, that is going to spread across the Democratic ticket and really be a weight on Kathy Hochul and other Democrats on the ballot in 2026.
Let's talk about the attorney general's race real quick. In Virginia, the Republican Jason Menendez seems to have a lead under a very star-crossed attorney general who just had a text message emerge that were 100% correct that said that he would like to kill a Republican's family if he had the opportunity and had enough bullets. What's your reaction to what's happening in Virginia?
Yeah, I mean, if you watch TV in Virginia, watch a football game this weekend, almost all the ad traffic was reminding voters about just how the endorsement, the text messages that Jay Jones, the Democrat, had to imagining violence against his political rival.
And here it is, three bullets, Gilbert, Hitler, and Pol Pot. Gilbert gets two bullets in the head. Spoiler, put Gilbert in the crew with the two worst people you know, and he receives both bullets every time. And then he went on to say, basically, it would be deserving if they killed his kids, too, who were like 3 and 5 at the time.
Yeah, I mean, it's disgraceful. And even like Abigail Spanberger, who's the Democratic nominee for governor, is not saying she's supporting. And she won't say she's not with Garner's support for Joe. But she's not. She knows that this guy is toxic. So, you know, I it's probably safe to say Meares is he was running behind. Now I think he's probably a slight favorite. But look, the Democrats, the polling was very favorable for Democrats in Virginia. But I think the government shutdown and certainly the Doge cuts probably played to their favor earlier this year. But I think this issue is so, I mean, all you have to do is turn on the TV in D.C. And if you live in the D.C. area or you live in Richmond, you're seeing all those texts from Jay Jones being flashed across the screen. I got to think it makes a big enough difference. And he's in political trouble.
And this is a law and order position. Lastly, New Jersey governor, the Quinnipiac poll, in my view, leans left, has Mikey Sherrill, a 6-point lead over Jack Cittarelli. But they say it's a toss up. And Mikey Sherrill now has a new explanation of why she didn't walk in her academy graduation. First, she says, because I wouldn't give up any of my friends in a cheating scandal. And then yesterday or the day before, she comes out and say, hundreds of people in my class spoke to investigators. When I was asked, I did and told them what I knew. Excuse me? That's a totally different story. So why were you not allowed to walk then?
Yeah, I mean, and she also tried to say that that information was released illicitly, which, you know, she's obviously the substance matters. Look, I think it's a problem. I mean, it's why the race is close, even though, you know, both in Jersey and Virginia, whenever you have a president of one party, historically, almost all the time, the governor's race goes the opposite way. So those are the headwinds that the Republican nominees are facing. But Sherrill has proven that she's not really closed the deal in New Jersey. The polling still shows the race very competitive. And that scandal, that controversy, and the fact that she's changed her story over her graduation, Naval Academy graduation, shows she still has a lot of vulnerabilities that are still yet to be litigated.
When she couldn't answer Charlemagne the God's question, where did you get your $7 million and you were fined for basically insider trading? And did you know if you made $7 million? I don't know. You think you did? Really? Long pauses. So, I mean, she's a terrible candidate.
Well, excuse me. What's awkward for Sherrill, she's one of the richest congressional districts in the country. She's you know, definitely, that's part of the problem for a lot of Democrats, that you have an affluent candidate that's out of touch with a lot of the working class voters. Working class voters in New Jersey, Brian, swung dramatically to Donald Trump in the last election. So she's had some challenges. Kind of the working class parts of the Democratic Party coalition haven't really connected with her, and she's had some real challenges on the campaign trail because of that.
It's fun time, Josh. Who ever thought an off-year election would have so much intrigue? I can't wait for the debates tonight in Virginia and in New York City. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Brian. Looking forward to it.
You got it. And by the way, there's going to be two in New York. There's going to be one next Tuesday, I think, too, but there's definitely going to be another. It's going to be exciting, although I'm going to the Al Smith dinner, and I've got my tux. Hopefully, I didn't forget any of the apparatus that allows me to wear. I had to wear a white tie and a tux. I hope I didn't forget anything. Back in a moment.
It's Brian Kilmeade. The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
The United States is the greatest and most powerful nation on earth, and American presidents need to be able to host events at the White House that reflect the demands of the time and that can be carry out the prestige of what we're all doing. The American presidents need to be able to showcase our country. So we'll begin the historic effort to add the, we'll call, presidential ballroom that'll expand the space for tens of thousands of people will be able to come during the course of a year if you add it all up and have the kind of space that you need. It's very exciting. To me, it's exciting as a person in real estate because you'll never get a location like this again.
So the president's building up the White House. You know, he's putting in the flagpoles. He's refurbishing things. He put up the presidential pictures of every president, including the auto pen for Joe Biden. I wouldn't have done that. But he was in the East Room yesterday. He had a big dinner for Microsoft, Google, Palantir, other companies who are supporting the $200 million building of this huge ballroom that could hold 650 people. I think it's a great idea. And is someone actually going to take it down? Oh, let's say someone comes in, they're anti-Trump. You're going to take down this ballroom paid for private money? Are they going to take down all the gold he put in? I mean, some of the stuff you could paint over, but the other stuff, I mean anything could be done. But he's also thinking about putting an archway right by Arlington National Cemetery because it would be a nice walkway through. And the guy has great taste. This is what he did for a living. So this time he's really putting his mark in every way, with policy to actual physical White House. Cannot wait for One Nation Sunday at 10 o'clock Eastern Time. And don't forget, see me in Pottstown, Pennsylvania, History, Liberty, Laughs, BrianKilmeade.com to go get tickets. I want to meet you. Get the VIP.